Comparing me this Friday at Brandalismos. I had some technical issues at the studio and the music will not be provided this evening. A very odd one through a telephone, through a microphone. So besides that, thank you for joining here in the studies of ancient world astrological esoteric library continuum. In the last session of Brandalismos, we finished actually the study of plant magic from the Dacian edition of Library Esoterica. And now we're going to have an overview of Nicholas Campion's History of Western Astrology, which is a two-volume publication from Bloomsbury. And yeah, thank you for joining. We're going to start with the Mesopotamian astrology and the writing of heaven. Son, God of heaven, my Lord, that omen which the moon God gave, if he found fault with me, accept ye. Son God of heaven and all, yeah, gods, these substitutes that I have given, and let me go free. It was astrologers of the classical world who attributed the origin of their discipline to ancient wise men, that is, the Chaldeans, as the Babylonian astrologers were called. In the Christian world, the knowledge that astrology originated in Mesopotamia was obvious to any reader of the Old Testament, the Chaldeans being familiar in the Middle Ages from the Book of Daniel, in which the term is synonymous with magician and enchanter, as well as astrologer. In the 16th century, the astrologer John Dee, one of the most notable scholars in Elizabethan England, so Chaldean, a language with which he cannot have been familiar, as one component in his planned reconstruction of the original language, including the language of cosmology of humanity. The earliest example of astrological practices in Mesopotamia have been traced to the late 3rd millennium, but the evidence is fragmentary, and the arguments about their nature polarize. There are a number of examples of astrological omens inscribed in clay tablets dated to the reigns of a series of most important monarchs of the period, although there are arguments about whether they are genuinely contemporary accounts or later reconstructions intended to illustrate the sky's enduring role in the history and politics. This is a plausible argument and is consistent with later astrological practice. It will also conform to the long tradition of the prophetic texts. This written after the events, which they conform to the long tradition and the prophecy. An example related to Babylonian history being told in the Old Testament, in the book of Daniel. There is actually a problem with almost all textual sources for Mesopotamian astrology. The majority of our early surviving texts date from the 7th century BCE. Omen series, the Enuma Anu Enlil. This is not a problem unique to Mesopotamian history, but afflicts our attempts to understand ancient wisdom as a whole. We need only think of the problems of dating the books of the Old Testament. One tablet, which has a reasonable claim to being genuinely early, apparently dates from the reign of Sargon, ruler of Akkad, from around 2334 to 2279 BCE. It reads simply, "When the planet Venus, an omen of Sargon, of the king of the four quarters, when the planet Venus, so it is an omen of Sargon." The clear implication is that a record was kept of the correlation of Venus' significant astronomical phases with important events in the king's life. Each correlation was then codified as an omen so that Sargon could be prepared for similar occurrences whenever the planetary pattern was repeated. This is only natural of the planets, after all, the visible representative in the sky of Inanna, the queen of heaven. In the cosmic hierarchy, when Inanna spoke, the king obeyed. The priestesses were, as we may expect, important. We know of one, Enheduanna, who seems to have been a highest priest of Nanna, or Suen, the moon god, as well as daughter of Sargon himself. She was the author of 42 extant hymns to Inanna, which survive only from the old Babylonian period, around 500 years after her death. We can get a flavor of the devotion with which the goddesses was regarded from the hymn which was written to venerate the goddesses when Venus appeared after the sunset as a herald of night. At the end of the day, radiant star, the great light that fills the sky, the lady of the evening appears in the heavens. The people in all the lands lift their eyes to her. The men purify themselves, the woman cleans themselves. The ox in his yoke lows to her. The sheep stirs up the dust in their fold. All the living creatures of the steppe, the four-footed creatures of the high steppe, the lush gardens and orchards, the greens, reeds and trees, the fish of the deep and the birds in the heavens. My lady makes them all hurry to their sleeping places, the living creator and the numerous people of the Sumerian, of the Sumer, kneel before her. Those chosen by the old woman prepare great platters of food and drink for her. The lady refreshes herself in the land. There is great joy in summer. The young man makes love with his beloved. We can imagine the ascent as a priestess of Inanna welcoming the rising of her planet, Venus, as night fell and the air was filled with singing, music and incense. This was the religious context between which the astrologers set to work on their deeply rational attempt to identify the divine will. By the late 3rd millennium, if not earlier, the sun, moon, and the five planets each seem to have been allocated to a deity, Inanna or Ishtar, queen of the heaven, was given the planet Venus. As well as the richest mythological tradition, the core drama of Inanna's life was her love affair with Dumuzi, or Tammuz, the shepherd king, his betrayal and death, and her descent through the seven gates of the underworld to rescue him, shedding an item of jewelry or clothing at everyone with all its agony and passion. Inanna's descent that was commemorated in rituals with which may have been at once solemn and hysterical, not unlike those in which statues of the Virgin Mary as a Queen of Heaven are carried in the processions in Catholic Eastern parades. The climax of the procession was the statue's arrival at the palace, in which point it actually was the goddesses. It was alive, as we read in one letter. Tomorrow, Shatru Ishtar will arrive early for Milkat and enter before the king. How will the king, my lord, fall under the gaze of Ishtar? The question was far from pointless. The priests had to know whether the king wished to enter the chamber before the statue or after. The choreography had to be conducted impeccably, and the king, taking on the spirit of the Musi, the goddess's lover, had to make his wishes known. We can imagine the scene, alternately despairing and joyful, in the scared, sacred precinct of Inanna's temple, the Eanna, as priestesses, singers, dancers, and musicians created an atmosphere of sublime religious devotion. In its earliest form, the rituals probably included an act of sacred sexual intercourse between the high priestess, representing Inanna, and the king, embodying the Musi. In the story of Enmerkar and Enkugestana, the king of Arata boasts that he will lie with Inanna on her adorned bed, communing with her face to face, to which his rival suitor Enmerkar, king of Uruk, boasts that he will lie with the goddesses on the splendid bed, which is strewn with pure plants for no less than 30 hours. Inanna was a prodigious cosmic force, capable of making love for no less than 30 hours. She was both a spiritual power who appeared in dreams and a physical one who aroused passion, desire, and fertility. Through her physical union with the king, she endowed him with the power to reign for another year, and her love and bounty were conveyed to the entire natural world. The rivers flowed, plants bloomed, and the harvests were rich. The tale had a profound emotional appeal, and the worship of Tammuz was widespread. In the 16th century BC, the prophet Ezekiel angrily denounced the Jewish woman who wept and wailed at the annual commemoration of his death. The appeal of sevenness in mythology is profound, in that the number may relate to the seven creator deities, or the sun, the moon, and the planets, or perhaps to a quarter of the lunar phase. The Babylonian calendar did not identify the week. We may suspect an analogy with ritual space and define time. Through the numbers' connection with the sun, moon, and planets, we may imagine a celestial journey, through one which descends to the darkness rather than the much later Hellenistic notion of an ascent to heaven through the seven planetary spheres, suggesting that there may have been some corresponding and still to be found Sumerian notion of an ascent to the stars. Inanna certainly possessed 7 temples in 7 cities and prepared herself for her descent with 7 mi, or protective powers. The planets were distinguished from the other stars by their erratic movements and were known in Sumerian as the Udu-Idim-Mes. Udu-Idim-Mes, or wild sheep, in Akkadian, Bibu, the modern term planet being derived from the Greek word for wanderer. The Babylonians also knew them, at least by the late 2nd millennium. As keep changing its positions and crosses the sky, together 6 gods who have the same positions and who touch the stars of the sky and keep changing their positions, or keep changing their positions and their glow and touch the stars of the sky. If the stars and the solar and the lunar calendar represent the order in Mesopotamian cosmos, then the planets cross the boundary between order and disorder. They lie at the heart of the dialectical relationship between the shamanistic and heumantic cosmologies that gave Mesopotamian cosmology its practical application. The sacred calendar, governed by the cycles of the sun and moon, was to be respected at the risk of the breakdown of political and social order. Yet the constant variation in their visual appearance encouraged diversity. Similarly, Venus was strictly tied to its fifth year cycle. Ishtar retained the ability to speak to her earthly subjects through minor variations in the planet's movements. Each planet provided a tool for its presiding deity to communicate with his or her subjects through its changing appearance and shifting location. As a planet moved or changed its appearance, so the divine intent was adjusted. Examples from the Assyrian period include the following. If the moon becomes late at an inappropriate time and does not become visible, it warns of attack of a ruling city. If it was observed in the sixth of the month, it favored the king of Subartu, or if it was surrounded by the halo through which another planet could be seen, then omen warmed, robbers will rage. One of the oldest of the Sumerian celestial divinities was the moon god Nanna or Suen. The name later contracted to Sin, by which the moon is generally known in the cuneiform texts. The name may have been different in different meanings. Nanna may have referred specifically to the full moon, and Suen to the new crescent moon, for which there also appears to be a third name, Asimbabar, the new light. One Sumerian hymn praised Nanna as you who perfect in lordliness wear a right crown, a wisdom visage, noble brow, pure shape, full of loveliness. Your grandeur lies imposed on all lands, your glory falls over the clear skies. You, great Nimbus, is fraught with holy dread. Nanna was the presiding god of the third dynasty of Ur, where he was the object of great veneration. His festivities were celebrated on the 1st, 7th, and 15th of the month, and when the moon was invisible at the new moon, he was believed to have gone to the netherworld to judge the dead along with Utu, the sun, and special offerings were made to help him in his task. As an indication of Sin's importance, much later, 14 tablets in the 8th century BCE, Assyrian omen collection, the Enuma Anu Enlil, were devoted to the moon's appearance, and further 8 lunar eclipses. which were thought to represent a demonic attack on the moon. Aside from the Enuma Anu Enlil, about half of the astrological reports related to the Assyrian emperors deal with lunar phenomena. The reasons are obvious, for the moon is the second brightest celestial object after the sun. It possesses the fastest and the most dramatic cycle, moving rapidly from one phase to another, and unlikely the sun can be tracked at night and hence form relationship with the stars visibly passing through constellations. The sun was known in Sumerian as Utu, meaning bright, and in Akkadian as Shamash. Both are names of solar deities, but the two words could mean either the visible body of the hidden power between in the god. Utu has been described as the power in light, the foe of darkness and deeds of darkness. A god who dispensed justice across the natural and supernatural realms. In this role, he anticipated the Greek Apollo's role as the god to whom oracles were addressed, presiding over the art and science of divination from entrails. None of the other planets seem to have commanded nearly the same attention in astrological omens as the Sun, Moon, and Venus. That is even the case for Marduk, whose theological status was made clear in the creation epic, the Enuma Elish. It was he who gave the other celestial deities their roles, and hence his hand may be seen behind, for example, the hundreds of omens devoted to the moon. He may always be ready with the blessing. One Assyrian astrologer wrote to the king, "We kept watch, we saw the moon. May Nabu and Marduk bless the king, my lord." Saturn, the faintest and slowest moving of the planet, was sometimes referred as the god Ninurta in the text, but also as Udu Idim Sag, Uz, in Akkadian Kahamanum, meaning the steady or the stable planet, and has no single tablet dedicated to it in the Enuma Anu Enlil, and only 25 mentions in the surviving reports to the Assyrian emperors. This does not necessarily imply a lack of power, but the sheer absence of variety in its appearance and location meant that on poorly functional grounds it was far less useful than, say, the moon, as that on a source of omens. In this sense, astrology was pragmatic. It worked with the material at hand, which may not reflect theological priorities. Mars, assuming its later astrological character, was invariably responsible for evil omens, being associated with Nergal, a god of the underworld, forest, fires, fever, plague, and war. The planet's malefic tendencies were heightened when it was bright, diminished when it was faint, and when it was its reddest, it may signify prosperity, but also an epidemic or of plague. Mercury was usually identified as the planet of Nabu, the son of Shamash, and therefore seems to be connected to the crown prize. In one Assyrian text, Mercury's approach to Regulus, the king star, warned of an attempt by the higher to seize the throne. The logic was clear, as the celestial signifiers of crown prince and king moved closer, so their earthly counterparts were heading for a collision. As the scribe of the gods, Nabu was given the important task of writing the destinies, announcing divine intentions to the diviners and astrologers, and he consequently joined Ea and Murduk as a god of wisdom. With the exception of Marduk, a god who only rose to prominence under the First Babylonian Empire after 18 BCE. We have no idea when these associations were made, nor whether they had evolved over thousands of years or were deliberate invention by an organized priesthood. When they were first outlined, though, is less important than the fact that the entire natural environment provided the principal means of communication between humanity and the pantheon of invisible gods and goddesses. The religious imperative in Mesopotamian astrology was persistent and profound, and rituals and prayers could be addressed to any divinity who possessed stellar associations, often at times determined by the moon synodic cycle at the new or full moon. A notably poetic incantation we know as the prayer for the gods of the night survives from the Assyrian period, but probably dates back to the old Babylonian Empire before 16 BCE. In these texts, as the prayer for inspiration, the astrologers will have asked, "Stand by me, O gods of the night, heed my words, O gods of destinies, Anu, Enlil, Ea, and all the great gods, I call to you, Delibat, Venus, Lady of Battles, or Lady of the Silence of the Night. I call to you, O Night Bride, Violet by Anu, Pleiades, stand on my right, Kidney Star, stand on my left." The most elaborate prayers were those designed as lifting of the hand, describing the gesture to be performed with hands raised up to heaven. From Assyrian tablets, we know of such prayers, which may be addressed to the arrow star Sirius, the brightest star in the sky after the planets, the Pleiades, the true shepherd of Anu, Orion, and the Vagon, today Ursa Major. The old Babylonian prayers, probably from the 18th to 17th century BCE, list 10 constellations by name, most of which were ones that the sun passed through, suggesting some religious significance attached to the sun. In one tradition, it seems that the entrail diviner will recite the prayer late at night, prior to performing the divinatory act of dawn. As the sun god, rose and restored light to human understanding, the diviner was not alone, but was accompanied by the stars and constellations, the living beings who acted as his or her advisors. Our early surviving account of the practical use of astrology to manage the state occurs in the dream of Gudea, the N lord of the city-state of Lagash, around 2000 BCE. The story features the goddess Nash-he, also known as Nisaba, who may have been an anecdote and antecedent of the scribe god Nabu, Mercury. Nanshi was said to measure heaven and earth, to know the secrets of calculations, and together with Suen or Sin, the moon god, to count the days. Nanshe associated functions as goddess of grain and as the expert on accounting and the fair management of resources, hint at both the practical uses of astronomy in agriculture and the benefit of a well-regulated calendar in maintaining social order. Her temple in the city of Eresh was called the Imulmul, the House of Stars, and she was the owner of a lapis lazuli tablet, which is known variously as the Dubmul'an or Dubmal'anku. The tablets with the stars of the heavens, or the tablets with the stars of the pure heavens, this she consulted by placing in on her knees. the story of the dream, of which we have a very full account, reveals with dramatic force the inter